Hello and welcome to the seventh episode of Talking Future, a new podcast by the Entrepreneurs Forum, where we talk to Northeast entrepreneurs about their work, their lives, and especially their views on the future and how they're innovating as they plan ahead. I'm Yvonne Bell, and today I'm talking to Isabella West, founder of Higher Street. Fashion has always been close to Isabella. While her mum was a fashion and beauty magazine editor, it was growing up with two sisters who would borrow her clothes and lend them to their friends that introduced her to the borrow not buy approach. In 2017, fast fashion was thriving, though the negative environmental impact of wear once clothing was still relatively unknown. Determined to tackle fashion waste, Isabella launched Higher Street, which allows customers to rent a range of occasion wear for an affordable price. In 2 years, Isabella has won a multitude of business awards, including the Young Business Executive of the Year Award, and is featured on Forbes 30 Under 30 Europe list. Good morning, Isabella.
Morning.
How are you? Are you okay today?
Yes, very good.
Good. In the introduction, I mentioned there that your mum and your sisters were sort of the inspiration to this, but how did it all start and what is your background in career?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I definitely grew up sharing clothes. Having two sisters so close in age just meant that, you know, if my mum was buying a dress for me, being the oldest, she very much knew that my two younger sisters would get wear out of it too. And I suppose that kind of mentality has carried through with me my whole life. So, you know, you have some people who describe themselves as foodies. Well, when I was younger and I kind of like worked Saturday jobs, I saved every penny to spend on fashion. I just loved it. And when I was spending, you know, I was in the shops browsing thinking, oh, I love that, but that would also look great on my best friend Chloe, or that would also look great on my best friend Henry. And I've just always had that kind of like sharing mentality really ingrained into me. And so the combination of that and the fact that really I loved fashion and I would save all my kind of money to spend on fashion, I think that was very much like, that's kind of like the side context, I suppose. I, you know, when I was at school, I introduced a concept of something called swap shop, which was back in the day when we used to buy everything from Topshop. We used to come to the common room and exchange our dresses after each 18. So everyone would be in something new for the next one.
And that's a good idea.
It was, yes, that was kind of like the very first stages of Higher Street, I suppose, in some way. Let's call it like market research 7 years ahead of actual launch. And then I went off to university. I studied economics and that then went into the city, and I was a consultant. And I suppose in those years, I was just building skills, like understanding a bit more about the world of business. It gave me great kind of exposure to different industries, different levels of management, different ways of thinking about business problems. And I absolutely loved my time as a consultant, but I always felt like I wanted to do something for myself, and I always wanted to start my own business. And then I suppose it kind of came to a bit of a head, really, when I was working. I was a consultant working on a project for Selfridges Group. Right. And I basically was tasked with the concept of looking at what the future of retail would be like. And one of the ways we do this, you know, we look at industry reports, but it's particularly in the UK, we take inspiration from what's going on elsewhere. And in the US and also in Australia, there was this kind of new and emerging trend of people renting their clothes, and particularly women. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was sitting there thinking, right, well, I definitely, you know, I love this space. It wasn't even a light bulb moment. It was just a moment of like, why is no one doing this? This is so obvious. And also this is something that I felt like I was exactly the right person to do. So I suppose I kind of was reading that. I was building out this project, and I spent probably 6 weeks thinking, do I, don't I? And eventually, you know, at that point, 6 weeks later, I was so in love with the concept of rental fashion and so bought into the fact that it should be in the UK that I left my role and launched the business. Mm,
that's a bit of a jump, isn't it?
I know. So
how does it work in practice then?
So basically what we would do is We purchase from stores, brands directly. So we work with them to try and curate a selection of items that we think our customers would like to rent. So typically that might be, you know, a dress that you would wear to a wedding or a dress that you would wear to the races. So often formal wear. Mm-hmm. And we'd also look at things like fit, size and fit. You know, it's often easier to rent a wrap dress because it fits multiple different people better than, you know, a very tight fitting structured dress. So we look at everything from, you know, fit to durability to the material that the garment is made from, to kind of how quickly that brand would sell out and how in demand we think those items would be. And we basically curate a very specific collection of items that we then list as available to rent. And then we've built our own website, which I would describe as a mixture between ASOS and booking.com. So as a customer, you go onto the website and you browse your, you know, you browse products just as you would on ASOS. And then at the point where it comes to selecting your size, you're also asked, how long do you want it for? And what is your delivery date? And that's where kind of the hotel aspect comes in. And then basically you just place your booking and your dress arrives with you on the day, you wear it, you take all your photos, you go to your event and you feel amazing. And then, you know, 4 days later, you pop it back in the returns bag, which is prepaid, drop it at the post office. It goes up to our warehouse in Glasgow and then it gets dry cleaned and made ready for the next weekend where someone's going to an entirely different event.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. It's just that the fact that you've got all that sort of logistics going on, it must have taken some organizing in the first place. So what sort of means did you use to sort of get the setup, and why Glasgow, for example?
So we actually specialized, well, so the warehouse that we use in Glasgow is specialized for rental. So there's not that many of them in the UK. And effectively what that means is obviously there's plenty of distribution warehouses that we could have worked with, but actually ACS Clothing, which is our partner up there, they're amazing. You know, every item is chipped. So we have a radio frequency tag, which tells us where it is in the warehouse. Items, you know, can be dispatched 1 hour from booking because they're kind of all, you know, we track where they all are in the warehouse. They have massive dry cleaning facilities built into their warehouse. So traditionally, if you purchased an item, you know, it's effectively someone takes it off a shelf and dispatches it to you. For us, with that relationship, it's built to be circular. So there's a dock where things come in and there's a dock where things go out, and the stage of coming the items coming in is amazing. You know, you've got someone there checking it, saying, okay, does it need repairing, does it, what level of cleaning does it need, and it's all then filtered, all the stock is then filtered, and it goes through an ozone chamber to destroy any bacteria. It goes through, either depending on the care label, like either a full dry clean or a wet wash or a hot wash, and then, you know, we will fully quality check it again, and then send it through a steam tunnel before like sending it up to wait for its next booking. So honestly, the warehousing solution has been a godsend to us because they are absolutely brilliant, and you know, we can turn dresses around so quickly, and it really is half of what makes the business work.
Well, that part could have been a nightmare.
It could have been, and to be honest, you know, we had to prove scale before we were able to move to the warehouse. So in the early days, I was very much trying to manage the logistics myself. So I would be running between, you know, the dry cleaners, all different dry cleaners in Newcastle, depending on what, you know, which items were where, and running to like different delivery points. And honestly, I always remember that, like, that was probably in the first 6 months, and the business definitely kind of took off faster than I initially thought it would. And I didn't have a warehousing solution sorted at that point. And to say that, you know, sleep was minimal, would be an understatement. I was, you know, up at all hours trying to figure out which dress was going where and where they all were in our kind of local dry cleaning network up in Newcastle. So it was amazing to be able to actually kind of like take that next step once we hit scale to outsource our operations.
So do you actually, do you work from Newcastle now, or are you based somewhere else?
It's a very timely question with COVID. So we have an office based in Newcastle. However, we haven't been using it. We've all been working from home. As a business now, we are increasingly open to people working remotely, and that can be from anywhere, really. So I actually was really lucky. I managed to get away this summer to Portugal and work from there. We've had staff working in the south of France. We've got people working in London. Because we're a technology business fundamentally in terms of what our head office team do, we've really kind of embraced a life post-COVID in terms of remote working. And yeah, that's been amazing. But Newcastle is definitely very much where we will always kind of like see home as.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the sort of the fashion and the sustainability part, is that still what your thoughts are behind it? Is that why you still like to do it? Because it's actually recycling, basically, isn't it, in its own way?
Yeah, so 100%. The motivation when I first started the business was that fashion was so wasteful. And, you know, 3 years ago, we didn't necessarily know just how bad fashion was in terms of the sustainable side. But when I say wasteful, I mean more like, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me to buy a dress and wear it once. Like, it makes sense to me to buy a dress if you love it and then try and see if your friends want to wear it next, or, you know, try and get use out of that dress. It's built, it's beautiful, you know, it's designed to go in on many outings and to many different occasions. So I think that was very much why I started the business, was kind of because I just thought the system as it currently was broken. I think the rise of fast fashion and the rise of Instagram meant that so many of my generation were literally buying and wearing once, and that just didn't make sense to me. So that was very much motivation at the beginning. I think increasingly, you know, as the world and our team as well have, you know, there's been more data, there's been more research on the polluting impacts of fashion. That's just kind of like powered our cause, and, you know, motivated us even further to improve what we do as a business, and how transparent and accountable we are. And I think, like, what's also really interesting is when we speak to customers, like trying to understand what they want and what's motivating them to rent. And it very much is coming back to that value point. So people want to be sustainable. You know, if they had a sustainable option and a non-sustainable option and they were the same cost, then, you know, the majority of people will take the sustainable option. But the problem has been, in fashion, that's just not the case. Like, often you're paying massive premium for a sustainable garment. And I suppose the purpose of Higher Street is to make a sustainable fashion offering that's very accessible, so you're not compromising on price to kind of be able to wear something that you love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, some of the brands such as H&M's got a latest advert that seems to be on the sort of bandwagon of sustainability. I mean, do you think that is just paying lip service to it, or do you believe that that's what's happening?
I think H&M specifically do care. I think that there are other fast fashion players where I think that they are kind of more seeing sustainability as a tick box. But H&M, I think, you know, they've got teams of people working on how to make their business model better. They have kind of really put, I suppose, they've really proved that they are serious about this. They obviously, you know, every business of that size has a long way to go. It's not easy to kind of just transition to, you know, make your business fully circular or fully sustainable. But genuinely, I think they have proven that they mean what they say by the resource and, well, basically by the resources that they've put behind their sustainability. And I think it's really interesting, and it's something that I get asked on a lot, is around the concept of, you know, our brand's greenwashing, and how do we know to trust, you know, H&M if they've got a big sustainability advert. And I think for me, what I would say is, obviously we don't know, you know, there's a huge lack of transparency, but what's important is that they are, well, there's an element of what's important here, and that is that the customer is seeing that sustainability is important to that brand as well. So, you know, that then filters down into, you know, the customer's thinking, how the customer thinks about sustainability. And I think the more
how you buy,
the more we talk about it, the better. I get worried when I would never want to say criticize anyone who's trying to be sustainable, even if they're not perfect, because it is such a journey to get there. And what even is perfect, to be honest? I think anyone who is, you know, moving in that direction and trying and committing resource to improving their operations for the better, then I think that should be celebrated. And I think that they're, you know, not only because of what they've chosen to do, but also because that message is going to the customer, and then the customer absorbs that message and it impacts their next decision as well. So I think progress is great in that space. And yeah, but I recognize that there is a very long way to go for a lot of retailers.
But also for the buyer, you know, the buyer like me, you know, how do you change the way you think about what's in your wardrobe? And and that's for men and women. You know, we all want to wear something new.
Absolutely.
And you get sick of wearing the same old things, especially at the minute.
I know. And COVID's so interesting to understand what the impact will be, you know, on fashion. And we still aren't seeing proper events go ahead. But my gut feel is that, you know, come next year, where people are allowed to their first big wedding, or, you know, where people are allowed to go back to the races, or whatever it is, that first big event, people are going to be more desperate to get dressed up than ever.
And just getting back to that, prior to rental platforms like Hire Street, the sustainable fashion thought is more perceived as something that an expensive thing. So say you're going to a wedding, you're going to the races or a big event. Is that the level you're approaching?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we have very much evolved in line with what our customers have wanted. So when we first launched, we were, I would say, very much kind of competing with at a high street level. And so by that, what I mean is, you know, our average rental price was often as low as £15 for a garment. And that was to rent a dress that was maybe £50 to £70. So that was when we very first started. And what we started to learn from customers is actually it wasn't that they wanted to rent the dresses that they could afford. So they weren't wanting to rent £50 items, because that was what they were frequently buying. What they wanted was to be able to spend a bit more on their rental and get a dress that they wouldn't typically be able to afford. So we very much launched, and then, you know, we only had 100 dresses to begin with. So then we started getting this feedback from customers, and we started to kind of take that on board, and we pivoted our buying a bit more. So we now, I would say, increasingly purchase dresses that are maybe, you know, £100 to £300 to buy, and then they rent for anything, you know, between £15 and £50. And it's absolutely the case that we have seen occasions and events be a key source of our demand. So we very much know that weddings in the summer is often our core category. And taking that into consideration, what we now know from a customer is that on average, someone going to a wedding would look to rent an outfit for about £35 on Hire Street. That's kind of our core price point for our weddings category. And so that basically means that that dress probably costs £200 plus, but obviously that customer is willing to pay that kind of more premium, should we say, rental price compared to where we first started for that luxury experience. And that's absolutely something that we've just kind of like learnt and kept listening to customers for. We take requests for brands, we take requests for stock. So it's been a case of, like, you know, working together with our community and saying, well, what would you want to rent? And often, you know, if you told me what you would want to rent, I think there's a lot of similarity in the world of, like, okay, if you think that it would be a good decision to purchase that dress, then others in our community will probably also like that dress. It's just about, you know, including, getting feedback from the people who are actually using your service. Mm-hmm. So it's been amazing. And then actually, I think what's been really interesting now in a world with COVID is that we've actually, and you know, this is still surprising to me, we're actually, in terms of August dispatches, we were 58% up on last year.
How can that be?
And what's so interesting is, so exactly, where are they going? It turns out they're going to the pub, they're going to restaurants, they're going on date nights. So what's happened is we've seen people take they've opted to kind of rent the more affordable dresses on our website. So we've seen a big drop in average rental price, down from kind of £35 plus to closer to the £20 mark. But people are still renting, and they're renting the more affordable garments and they're dressing them down. And what's amazing to see is that, you know, does that mean that there's a structural shift now? Does that mean that people are embracing rental for not just events? Has COVID actually accelerated rental in the world of retail? As in, you know, are people seeing it actually, you know, I during COVID didn't spend that much money, and I, you know, became more aware of the things that I owned, and people did think more about sustainability during lockdown. And, you know, have we come out on the other side of it and people are embracing rental for everyday life? Because if yes, and that's certainly what that data suggests, that's so powerful, because previously we would have described ourselves as a business based on events. And now, you know, everything's kind of a bit more up in the air. We're actually this next Monday launching a collection for jeans and a nice top, because we've kind of had feedback from customers that they want to be able to spend, you know, less money. So say £10 to rent a top just to go to a restaurant in next week with the girls.
Mm-hmm. And then they can send it back and get another one in a few weeks' time.
Absolutely.
And they haven't bought it. It's a strange concept when you bring it to that level, because, you know, when you're talking about just going to the pub or a date night or something, in this sort of day and age with COVID, it's become quite an event to go out. never mind go to the races, you know. Just going to the pub can be quite an event. And you may be seen more because you're standing in a queue to get in.
Absolutely. And I think also what's funny is there's almost in some ways a perfect storm here, because people, because of obviously track and trace and because of the limitations on numbers and restaurant bookings, you know, whereas this time last year on a Friday night, am I going to the pub? I probably still don't know at midday on Friday, but I would just pop down. Whereas now people are booked in their pubs for the next 2 weeks, so they know what their events are, because they have to have these plans in advance, and therefore they start thinking about their outfits in advance,
which you would do on a more of a special occasion, or what would be seen to be a special occasion. When you read about sustainable fashion, the terms ethical fashion and slow fashion are often intertwined. Is there a difference in that?
Yes, I mean, it's so interrelated. And the problem we have with fashion is that, especially with fast fashion, is that, you know, you can go from design to production and delivery, and, you know, some brands will talk about a turnaround time of 2-3 weeks, which is incredibly rapid. So, you know, in terms of that, and then to be able to do that process so quickly, and to then, you know, only charge £10 for a dress, someone somewhere is paying for that, you know. So it might be garment workers, it might be that, you know, the brand is not doing everything they can in terms of the sustainability side and material sourcing, or, you know, so basically the speed can cause problems in terms of making unethical decisions. And I think, so they're very interrelated. But, you know, you can have brands that are slow fashion brands, so they don't necessarily work on rapid turnaround times, but because margin is so competitive, they might still take 6 months to produce, but they might not necessarily have fully investigated how ethical their full supply chain is. So they might know the surface level factory and they might think that that's good, but they don't know, you know, what the material, where the materials come from, or other areas of the kind of garment supply chain that could have associated issues. So I would say speed and, you know, there is a relationship between how ethical production is and speed, but it's not exclusive, and there can be issues. You could have a rapid, more ethical supply chain, or you could have a slow, unethical supply chain. It's really up to the retailer, and it's how on it they are with investigating, you know, their own factories and their own operations.
The fashion houses keep getting caught out, don't they?
And honestly, it breaks in the news, and you're thinking, how did they not know? And I speak to brands all the time about their sourcing, because one of the things that we are trying to do is have basically a sustainability index on our site for the brand. So, you know, you can choose to rent from brand X or brand Y, and that's great, but you might also want to know, but how sustainably are their garments made? And because it's not just on the consumer to be, you know, obviously you're making a great choice by renting, but what if the brand you're supporting by renting is not necessarily a great brand? So we've been working with our brands to try and help them build towards a sustainability index and to try and then, you know, convey that to our customers. And the truth is, there is a lot that people don't know. You know, a lot of fashion brands find a factory and, you know, if they're happy with the samples, they're happy with the samples and they go from there. They don't heavily investigate.
So, I mean, how in the next 5, 10 or 20 years, how do you see the fashion industry changing? I mean, it's changing already because the high street is being decimated by things that have happened, not just COVID, but just over the years. It's the online trend has been high. So what's your forecast? Do you look that far?
So I think there's a couple of things. I definitely think that we will see an increase in like circular business models. So whether that's rental or whether that's secondhand, I think there is just with the increased information available around like issues on sustainability and with improved technology to make, you know, rental more easy to do or secondhand shopping less of a kind of like, I don't know, you know, we've all kind of have, well, I personally, before recent experiences, could associate secondhand shopping with, you know, poor experiences in store where actually, you know, you don't find something you like and, you know, the stuff in there is, it's not necessarily good vintage, should we say. And, you know, I think a lot of people have that kind of negative association, but increasingly we see amazing secondhand retailers coming up and, you know, businesses who have developed technology to take stock back and to photograph it and then list it for sale. And you know, it's the same in the world of rental. There's so much improvement in the world of like circular fashion that there's no way that won't become more prevalent, especially with the increased awareness around sustainability. So I think we'll definitely see more of that. I definitely think, you know, the shift to online will stay. I think in store we'll see people more focused on experiences for those people who keep stores. So we might see, you know, opportunities for like kind of VIP customer nights or, you know, in-store fashion shows. This is in a world past COVID, of course. I think, you know, people will use stores more as an opportunity to connect with their customers, but I would expect more and more actual kind of like e-commerce, like actual distribution and ordering to go on online. I think COVID has also accelerated that. People have become much more savvy with their online shopping. I think obviously the flip side of that is a booming returns industry. There's lots of kind of changes on the horizon. I mean, I was on a webinar the other day and we were talking about virtual fashion. So effectively, like I could be sitting here just in a black vest top, but I've actually got some sort of virtual plugin on my Zoom that projects, I don't know, like a designer top onto me. And, you know, you guys on the Zoom call with me wouldn't know that I'm not wearing
like that
top. So, you know, I mean, I've heard it all, I feel like, recently. And I think that seems so far off now. But of course, you know, in a world where people are more and more working remotely and, you know, people have so much, I don't know, reliance on their virtual persona, virtual fashion will increase.
Yeah. And this isn't part of your recently launched try-on service, is it? You're not doing that, are you?
No. I would love to be able to virtually render all of our dresses and to let people try on thousands of items at home at once. I think that technology would be amazing. If anyone's out there building that, please drop me an email.
So what is your try-on service?
So the try-on service is something that we launched in lockdown to basically help our stock move a bit. You know, we had thousands of dresses sitting in the warehouse and then also we had lots of customers sitting at home thinking, oh gosh, when can I go to my next event? Or like, what am I, you know, am I going to make it to that wedding in December? Or and basically what we did is we built a service which said to customers, have fun at home, order 5 dresses from, you know, brands you don't know, go a bit, you know, be adventurous in your styles that you choose and try them on in the luxury of your own home and then just send them back to us. And either, you know, you've found a new brand that you love and you'll rent in the future, or you found a style that you can't wait to book out for the next event you're going to. So it's basically just a way to kind of engage our customers and use our stock. And it, honestly, it was amazing. We got sent so many incredible selfies of people taking photos of themselves in a mirror at home during lockdown.
So you had fun from that as well then?
Yeah, absolutely. And we really did get great content from it. There's lots of things that actually we didn't necessarily plan at the beginning that were great benefits of the try-on. So we really are very community focused. So if you rent a dress, we really encourage you to, and we reward you to leave reviews. So if you've rented a gown and they said, okay, this was beautiful, but it runs a bit large, then leaving that as a review is so, so valuable. And if you've taken a selfie in it, all the better, because it means that a customer is so much more likely to convert if they've seen it on someone that they can relate to and not necessarily just on a model. So actually, you know, the hundreds of garments we were sending out to be tried on each week were actually brilliant, because we got all of them got reviewed because customers had time to leave reviews. And we got lots of kind of images to support how they fit. And
it's like research then, almost. You had a research sort of feedback thing going on.
Absolutely. We had such a good feedback loop. And then, you know, it came to July the 4th and people started to actually be able to go out a bit more. And, you know, there was customers saying, oh, I've been waiting to rent Tallulah since I tried it on in May. And, you know, it's amazing. So it was a really brilliant initiative. And we didn't realize how powerful it would be.
And is that something that you're going to continue, or is it just that was just a one-off?
So it's definitely something we're going to continue. Well, it's in the pipeline for now. I think the key thing for us is that we have thousands of garments, but, you know, in key months, so say like winter or December, obviously depending on what the state of the external world is, but if we took last December, for instance, we had 97% of our winter garments were booked out. So actually in those months, you don't want to be sending 5 garments to a customer to just try on, because you're not actually making revenue on those garments. So it's a balance. In the current situation, so, you know, September 2020, we haven't seen a return to events. We still have plenty of stock that we can use, and it's not an issue if customers want to try things on. I think the time where we'll have to be a bit more, we might have to limit try-ons is in booming months in a world post-COVID.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that comes shortly anyway, because it's nobody's particularly making money at the minute. But what about your tips for those who want to have a more sustainable wardrobe? I mean, it's not all about hiring. Are there any other issues within people's wardrobes that you think that you know, people should think carefully on?
I think, to be honest, so I speak to people about this all the time, and it's so interesting. And we're actually just in the process of launching a campaign which is focused around little changes. So it's basically, it's speaking to celebrities, speaking to influencers, speaking to, you know, you just normal people, normal customers, and saying, what is your sustainability tip, or what is the one thing that you do? And then we share those, so you kind of can be inspired by, you know, the little things that other people have done, and you know, how that approach can just make a really big overall impact. So I've heard some amazing tips recently. My personal one, because as mentioned at the beginning, I was so guilty for just loving to spend money on clothes. I have a rule that I have a set number of items in my wardrobe now. So I can't buy something new unless I've like rehomed or given to a friend, sold or donated to charity something that was already in my wardrobe. So it's a one in, one out system. Mm-hmm. I have to know that it's going to be more valuable, that the new item is going to be more valuable to me than something that's already in there. And I'm not just endlessly adding. I can't just go out and buy excess.
No, you're being very disciplined about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it makes you think a lot more. And I actually am in the shops and I'm like going through my like wardrobe in my head. And, you know, I've like thinking, what does this replace then? And who am I going to give that what I'm giving away? And am I willing to give that one that I'm substituting it away? And it really makes you think so much more. And I've heard amazing, I've heard some brilliant suggestions recently in terms of what people's little changes are. And I've heard, like, one of our customers has a list of her entire wardrobe on her phone, right? So she's out.
That is disciplined, isn't it?
It's amazing. So she's got pictures of it as well. And she's got, like, by drawer, what she's got in there, right? And so it's in her notes. So she's out and she's thinking, okay, do I need this? And she'll actually look at what she's got. And I know that sounds crazy because people should know what they've got, but, you know, often when you're in the moment, you see something you like, you kind of don't actually think about what you've got that's similar or what you could, you know, make do with. And so we've heard all sorts. We've heard, you know, obviously the kind of key things about if you're going to buy something, trying to think, like, does it work in summer as well as it works in winter? Like, can you make it cross seasons? You know, I think a lot of people talk to us about value per wear. So, you know, actually investing in quality garments for your wardrobe, because you're going to, you know, get lots of wears out of them as opposed to kind of just buying cheap. I think also planning in advance. We've all kind of got to that point where we buy, you know, we didn't necessarily realize that we really wanted a new outfit for the dinner that we're going to on Friday, and we get to Thursday and unfortunately we just kind of raid ASOS's new in and add to basket. And so lots of different tips from different women who are actually, like, actually living out these sustainability hacks, which is, it's been amazing. And I think finding what works for you is super important, but find something. And don't change everything at once, you know. You don't have to be perfect, but try and embrace a little change to begin with. And then, you know, once that's kind of ingrained, you know, embrace something else. We had examples of people saying, well, I started this with my wardrobe and then I actually decided that I'm going to do meat-free Mondays. And then, you know, it's just going at a pace that you feel comfortable with, but doing something is a lot better than doing nothing. So try not to be overwhelmed by, you know, oh gosh, you know, I don't know anything about sustainability, so I'm not going to do anything. Just try and choose the things that you can do and focus on the things that, you know, are in your control and change those. Yeah.
Is that you beeping?
I think it was my dishwasher beeping.
Now, you feature on Forbes 30 Under 30 list. Now, for the uninitiated, what is that? And what was it like when you found out you were going to get it?
So Forbes 30 Under 30 is basically a platform whereby different they have lots of different lists, but 30 Under 30 might be one of their most famous. And effectively they choose 30 entrepreneurs who are under 30 years old, and they effectively make a list and they talk about the positive things that they're doing in their respective industries. So they you know, Forbes have Forbes 50 Under 50 and Forbes 40 Under 40, but for some reason the 30 under 30 seem to generate the most interest out of any of the lists I've seen. And yeah, so it's amazing to be on it.
And that was for Europe, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, it was. And yeah, I mean, so how it all came about, I suppose I got an email one day saying, you know, you've been identified as a potential candidate, like, do you mind coming, like, doing this interview and, like, telling us more information about who you are and what you do and your vision for the business. And I was thinking, oh god, I'm never going to get this, and I wish I hadn't got this email, because now I'm going to be perpetually disappointed that it was brought to my attention. And I think that's maybe just, like, imposter syndrome kicking in, or just, I don't know what it was, but I was just so convinced that it was so far, it was just not a possibility to get that head on the list. So I did this interview, I filled it all out, and I tried not to think about it, because, you know, once I'd had that contact, I was thinking, oh my, I kind of was almost like thinking, wow, this would be amazing and I would want it so much. And yeah, I was, when it actually happened, I think it was a real pinch myself moment. It's probably, for me personally, it made a lot of what, you know, it hasn't always been easy building a business, and, you know, from fundraising to then COVID to everything that's gone on, you know, it there's been
setbacks,
you know, not a small amount of personal sacrifice or setbacks. So I think it was one kind of morning where I sat back and I thought, wow, that's actually something important to me now. And, like, that's something that I've done. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what anybody says, when you get an award like that, you get noticed, and it's got to help the business, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's silly things in terms of just having it on LinkedIn, and, you know, it's a credibility tick, really.
Yeah. Do you look outside your own sector and look at other entrepreneurs or businesses, and do you follow them? Do you follow any particular people? I assume you follow fashion.
I think there's people that I look up to in lots of different industries. I think there's not necessarily like kind of like designers or brands that I follow super closely. I think I'm much more aligned to like the business side and like the entrepreneurial side. Like I love fashion, but I'm far more interested in the styles necessarily than like following a specific designer. I think what I find really interesting is like the journeys of like entrepreneurs or like CEOs and that type of thing. So I've just recently read like the Disney book, which is amazing. It's by their CEO, and it's called The Ride of a Lifetime. I love, you know, the Shoe Dog book by the Nike CEO. I've followed kind of like the story of like Richard Branson, Steve Jobs, all of those kind of hyper successful entrepreneurs. I find that really, really fascinating and inspirational. I think hearing the ups and downs of their journey, particularly, you know, like understanding their first 5 years is so reassuring in ways, because you know anyone who's read Shoe Dog or even A Ride of a Lifetime, you know, you realize that like it's okay that the path isn't straightforward. Like you see the size of those companies now and you think, gosh, they just grew, and they didn't. You know, they had massive setbacks in their early days and they had to fight tooth and nail to get to where they are, and there's just something very reassuring about hearing other people's journeys and then knowing where they've got to.
So for people starting up, what sort of advice would you give to them? I mean, you've got so far with your business, is that through determination, or you know, what's your tip of the week to people for them to start up like you did?
100%. So I would say the summary of all of those kind of books and those inspirational stories that I love is grit. You know, you have to be resilient. You have to keep fighting. There is very, very tricky days ahead as an entrepreneur. And, you know, that's not negative. That's just realism. There's incredibly positive days. But you have to be kind of, you have to have the belief in yourself that you're the right person to lead that business and to, you know, to disrupt that sector, to keep going when things get tough. And I think that's like the key thing that I've found is like you have to focus internally and build your self-belief, and that then helps you become a lot more resilient when, you know, things don't go as planned. I think it also means that the other thing that I would say, and especially to anyone who's in a role, and I think most people are in a career before they decide to step out and start their own business, is like, you know, a comfort zone. And it's so easy for me to say now I'm on the other side of it, but I should have started earlier. That's my only regret, is that, you know, I was in a comfort zone and I kept saying to myself, oh, next year. And actually, as soon as you start to feel like you're not learning where you currently are, or you're not quite sure what your next step is, then check in with yourself and you know, understand that and start to plan for what's next, because it's, you know, it's all too easy to just become comfortable and 2 years have gone by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you haven't done what you thought you might do. So that's good.
Exactly.
That's good. And so just looking ahead for yourself, what are you looking forward to in your business?
COVID has taught us a lot about, you know, who we are as a brand and where we want to go. And one of the things that we've increasingly focused on is our technology. So we built Higher Street, the brand, and that's amazing. And we have lovely and brilliant customers. But one thing that we've increasingly started to understand, and it's something that we touched upon before when we were discussing what the future of retail looks like, is, you know, if actually we want to structurally change the fashion industry for the better, we need not just to build Higher Street, but we need to facilitate other brands to be able to rent items too. So what we're looking at the minute is the concept of white labeling our technology for retailers to power them in the world of rental. And it's incredibly exciting because, you know, if you think about Higher Street's market size and, you know, how much we have to grow to compete with on the scale of ASOS, we could talk to someone like ASOS and say, look, why don't you use our technology and, you know, try the world of rental for a select section of your products, and we'll go from there. And I think if, you know, in terms of making structural change to an industry, I think the tech platform and this new tech offering that we're building has the potential to be far more impactful.
Yeah, and it sounds exciting as well. So it's something to get your teeth into, isn't it?
Yes, it's been a really exciting couple of months after the initial kind of like COVID uproar and, you know, adjusting plans and making sure everyone was happy and working from home fine and that side of things. Yeah, it's been a really, really positive pivot.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Interesting subject. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.